Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We have a microloan program. For example, you could go into an FSA office and establish a potential loan opportunity that would provide you up to $50,000 to start a small agricultural activity somewhere where you live.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Why would you do that? Well, first and foremost, it would give you experience. Secondly, it would allow you to establish a track record with the FSA office, and it would allow you to meet the qualifications and requirements that you've been in the farming business for a period of time so that you could access a much larger operating or ownership loan that FSA could provide to you. We've just enacted a micro farm risk management tool. You might not have to buy crop insurance, but you'll have the ability to buy a program that protects your entire farming operation from disaster so that you would get started. So you have technical advice and assistance. You have access potentially to conservation resources. You have lending resources.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
USDA's latest round of crop reports had a couple of mild surprises for traders.
So USDA out with a new round of crop forecast, and yeah, a couple of mild surprises. Gary Crawford reports.
First, USDA forecasting a bigger corn crop than previously reported, bigger than most traders expected. USDA now looking at a 15.3 billion bushel crop. It had been saying 15.2. Either way, a record crop boosted by USDA's new improved corn yield estimate, 177.3 bushels an acre, taking corn yields also into the record books. For soybeans, USDA raising its previous yield forecast by about 1%, taking it to the fourth highest ever soybean crop. Now estimated just under 4.2 billion bushels, still down from the year before by 2%. And there was yet another surprise in the reports for the cotton market. USDA had been forecasting a 12% smaller cotton crop this year, now looks to be 14% smaller crop at 12.4 million bales. Even though yields look better than before, USDA upped its estimate of the number of acres that had to be abandoned because of drought. Gary Crawford, Washington.
Usually with WASD numbers, we think of row crops, but Rich Nelson, chief strategist with McHenry, Illinois-based Allendale, says there are livestock numbers as well.
There was a little bit here, and our focus really with these numbers for today at least is going to be on the beef side. We've got to point out, now, just 3-4 months ago, USDA was expecting about a 6% drop in beef production for this coming 24 year we're in right now. Now for today's discussion, they've been reducing that. They've been muting that reduction. As of today, they're only looking at about a 3% drop in the 24 production. And along with today's report, they did add to imports. They did reduce exports. So the amount that the U.S. consumer is going to see this year is going to be only about 2.7%. And the bulk of this production drop will be in the fourth quarter. So we still have 6 months ahead of very muted declines, maybe 1 to 2%. And then we'll transition back into much tighter supplies later this year in Q4. As far as pork numbers to speak of today, USDA did raise their production estimates. We kind of knew that would happen, though, because we are just coming off that hogs and pigs report from last month, which, as he said, we're at light liquidation, but productivity is much stronger this year in offsetting that story. So the general story for meats as a whole, including poultry, it didn't change much, but certainly for us on the beef side, a little concern. On the pork side, a minor concern with what USDA did here today.
So how do you maneuver through all of these, especially starting a new year? And Nelson says they have an opportunity.
So we've got a special event coming up here. So Allendale is for 2024. We're going to do, you know, we always have our big conferences in January and July, the ones where we do a full detailed workup of both the U.S. and world situation. Well, we're right around the corner for this next grouping of conferences. So on the 23rd, the Allendale Ag Leaders Conference will be going on, and we'll kick off our whole 2024 outlook on both U.S. and world perspectives, prices, and certainly a strong focus on marketing crops and livestock for this conference. And that's on the 23rd. Producers can give us a simple phone call and get signed up, 1-800, the number 2, and then market.
Rich Nelson is chief strategist with Allendale. Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Some of the same old battles, right? We're still talking about the lesser prairie chicken.
Ethan Lane is Vice President of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
We're still talking about wolves. We're still talking about grizzly bears in the Pacific Northwest. Some of those longstanding challenges that ranchers know all too well, in many ways are very similar to where they were 10 years ago. So it's been an interesting year in 2023 and 2024 going into a highly contentious presidential election with tight margins around the country. I can't imagine being much different. I think we're gonna still expect to see a lot of that type of volatility in both in the political environment, hopefully less so in the cattle market. And the one good thing to say about it is that because of the work of producers around the country and NCBA and our state affiliates, we're in good position to deal with it and move forward with some wins, hopefully.
Another area that's caught no traction, new trade deals.
This administration's legacy on the trade front is going to be one of shame. You have a U.S. trade representative in Katherine Tai who has said unapologetically that she doesn't believe exports are important anymore, and that instead she believes the focus needs to be on using our consumer footprint in the United States to change behavior in other countries around the world. We're seeing the effects of that with the decision of the Biden administration and the Department of Agriculture to allow Paraguayan beef imports into the United States, to refuse to take seriously Brazil's inability or unwillingness to play by international rules governing the reporting of disease outbreaks in their countries, and to continue to allow that product onto American store shelves, mostly in the form of lean trimmings. That's where most of that product comes into the United States. And it speaks volumes about how unseriously this administration has taken the need to open additional markets for not just agriculture, but for the cattle industry in particular. We aren't satisfied with that. And as is often the case in the cattle industry, we're taking matters into our own hands. And so we are continuing those conversations overseas, continuing to build bridges, continuing to engage internationally in that conversation, both to defend and promote the way we raise beef here in the United States, and look for opportunities to grow that market share. $11 billion in exports in 2022 to foreign markets from the U.S., more than $450 in value on every fed steer. That is a huge benefit to the supply chain, and something that we don't want to let our foot off the gas on just because this administration doesn't see value in it. So we're going to have to keep pushing on that, whether the administration's interested in talking about it or not, and keep that pressure on, because that's just not something we're willing to relent on.
He also talks about the upcoming cattle industry convention.
It is our favorite week of the year every year. The NCBA Cattle Industry Convention and Trade Show is so much fun and so much action packed into one week that you need a week afterwards to catch up on sleep. But we are headed to Orlando, Florida here in a few weeks, January 28th through February 2nd. We will be down in Orlando with 8,000 or so of our closest friends, talking through all these issues. All of our 7 standing policy committees will have full meetings. There'll be presentations from government agencies, from market participants, from analysts, economists, you name it. We're going to get into these issues, and we're going to talk to our affiliates around the country. We're going to go through our policy book, and we'll come out of that meeting with renewed priorities and a renewed focus and the ability to take these challenges head on in the next year. And that starts with participation in Orlando. So beyond the fun we're going to have down there, and there is going to be a ton of it, it's a great opportunity to work on the business of being in the cattle business as well. So we're excited to see everybody in Orlando in a few weeks.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, they have to watch how much control they exercise over the fund out of which the participating members are being reimbursed.
Have you heard of those rewards programs? Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist at Washburn University on what you should do regarding these rewards programs.
And that was really the key to the case. The control that they had retained in this instance made the argument impossible for them to say that they were just a trustee of the fund. They were just kind of managing it, but they're not exercising control over it. They were. There is an exception out there known as the trust fund doctrine established in a case involving 7UP back in 1950. But that didn't apply in this instance because of all of the control that the parent company had over that fund. funds. So it's a good case in terms of laying down a marker for those that are giving tax advice to clients that offer these customer loyalty reward programs. And the retail businesses that offer these and participate in these will want to ensure that the program is structured in a way that fits within this trust fund doctrine, the exception under that for excluding program funds from gross income. So I think it's a big case on the tax side of things.
Unrelated, but what is basis of assets contained in an intentional defective trust?
It's an estate planning technique for a very unique type of clientele, usually the wealthier clientele, so a large farming and ranching operation with a lot of wealth. It's a good estate planning technique that we can use as a succession planning transition type device. And what it is it's an irrevocable trust that has language in it that makes sure that the individual grantor, the person creating the trust, pays any income tax on the property that's contained in the trust. So you might transfer farm or ranch land to an intentionally defective grantor trust or other types of property. And if that generates income, you're still going to pay the income tax on that, even though you've transferred the property away from you and have gotten it out of your estate at time of death. And that's the idea here. So some would say, well, why would I want to do that? It's effective for estate tax purposes. It's defective for income tax purposes because even though I transfer all the property away and it's a separate tax entity, I still, normally it's a separate tax entity, but here I still pay the tax on it. Well, the idea is that the grantor is from the wealthier generation. They have the money and they're trying to move that property to the next generation. Well, let's not burden the next generation with the tax on that. I'll still pay the income tax on it so that farm or ranch land, that farm property that I transferred away, continues to appreciate tax-free, in essence, in the hands of my beneficiaries. And so that's the whole idea behind it. The question that has been out there for a number of years, the IRS finally answered it in 2023, was when that grantor dies, do the assets in that trust get a basis increase equal to fair market value at the date of the grantor's death? Do they get a stepped-up basis in the hands of the beneficiary? In other words, is the retained obligation to pay income tax on the income generated by the assets in the trust, even though I transferred them away from me, is that enough to cause inclusion in my estate to get a basis step-up in the hands of my heirs? They had vacillated on this for about 15 years. They'd gone back and forth. But finally, in 2023, they issued a revenue ruling, which is official policy of the IRS, saying that, no, you do not get a basis increase in the hands of the beneficiaries of that trust and those assets that are in that trust. So we're going to have to think about this in terms of its implications for estate plans where we have created intentionally defective grantor trusts. We now know that there won't be a basis increase in the hands of the beneficiaries.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
With corn down about 9 cents, this was a new low for this general downtrend.
Rich Nelson, chief strategist with Allendale, following USDA reports on Friday.
Soybeans at one point were down 33 cents and change. They rebounded and closed only down 10. So the main discussion for these reports used to give us some bearish information. For corn, looks like that information is going to stick. For soybeans, we still have a little questions about these next few months ahead here, though.
These were the first big reports of the new year from USDA.
You know, we got actually a few different reports from USDA today, and they kind of put them all into one central supply-demand report to keep it simple for us. And corn production was revised higher on this report. U.S. crop was revised higher by 108 million bushels. In fact, the yield change associated with that was tied with the second biggest yield change on a January report of the past 20 years. And USDA went down the line and they raised ending stocks from just over 2.1 billion bushels to now just under 2.2. So still a large corn supply story. Discussion is hot on South America's crops. Well, on the corn story, they only dropped them by 2 million tons today, left Argentina unchanged. So the corn story is relatively intact. No change there. The question for us is still with soybeans. Now, USD did add 36 million bushels to this past fall's production. They did not touch domestic crush or exports, which was a bit of a surprise. Stocks raised from 245 million bushels last month, now 280. And discussions for South America, well, they did drop Brazil's crop by 4, but they offset a good chunk of that with 2 million tons added Argentina. So the soybean story is more in flux, but for today at least, certainly a bit negative for this discussion here.
Well, there's usually an off-season for corn and soybeans and cotton. There's no off-season for wheat.
For our discussion with wheat, different than corn and soybeans, we do not usually see a U.S. production revision on this report. They can, but they do it only rarely. So with that in mind, the wheat balance sheet was really changed only minimally here today. Stocks dropping from 659 last month, now 648. Not a big market mover. What our focus was on for wheat specifically was the fourth report that USDA released today, the fall winter wheat plantings. And they really gave us a surprise with a 2.2 million acre cut for this year's fall winter wheat planting. And keep in mind, the vast majority of this was Southern Plains hard red. So Kansas, Oklahoma, and certainly Texas. We've got to point out, this does raise questions for acres on both new crop wheat ahead. So a little bullish, but this does give the corn and soybean acreage discussion a bit of a concern, with maybe a few extra acres waiting for them next spring.
And how could this affect cotton?
Keep in mind, especially because this acreage change for wheat was specifically with Central and Southern Plains, Kansas through Texas, this also does give us a little question about cotton acreage here for this discussion as well. Now, before this report, we all expected a minor decline for corn acres this coming spring, a minor increase for soybeans this coming spring. I do wonder, perhaps now with this extra acreage available for corn, soybeans, and cotton as well, maybe now we'll see maybe the corn have a little more of a pushback on the acreage side. Instead of down 2 million, maybe it will be down 3 or 3.5, and maybe cotton getting just a little bit of this extra acres lined up here.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It's not just about the temperature. We got to think about wind speed. We got to think about, the temperature, the moisture, all of these things kind of play into a key role that all of those things impact our animals.
Kansas State Extension beef veterinarian Dr. A.J. Tarpoff.
This winter in particular, we're going to have more moisture more moisture than what we've had the last several years. So that's a good thing, but also a concern when we start looking about cold stress. So how do we modify the environment? We can't control the weather, but how do we modify the environment to increase cattle comfort during these events? My first and foremost is bedding, whether it's wheat straw, whether it's corn stalks, any type of some of that spent forage material that's not going to be nutritional value, we can use as bedding. It provides a thermal layer to the ground where animals have comfortable area to be able to lay down, bed up. They're protected from that frozen ground, and it gives them a nice area to get out of the wind, get out of some of those elements. So yes, it's an expense to be able to put it out, to be able to pay for those things, but it does pay off in the end. For our newborn baby calves, again, they're being born into a very cold environment. So we want to have them in a protected area, hopefully with a windbreak. Wind and moisture are the two key elements we want to control for our cow-calf herds. So whether it's a portable windbreak or you actually calve in a protected site and some trees or a shelter belt, however that looks, I personally like movable windbreaks. We can move in different areas so we can control where we feed our animals. We can spread some of those contaminants, over a much larger area. However you do it, just make sure we want a windbreak and have a good bedded area for those newborn baby calves to get up, get dry, get that first nursing milk, and get off to a good start.
He also reminds us, don't forget to keep their bellies full.
Food is critical for cold stress, regardless of how big the animal is. A newborn absolutely needs that first colostrum very early in life, and to continue nursing to keep up that readily available energy level, because the body, it takes a lot of energy to produce heat. For our cows and for our production animals, all that energy that we're feeding them, it increases their maintenance energy requirements. So instead of growth, instead of lactation, all those extras, they are using the majority of what we're feeding them just to maintain body temperature. So that means whenever it gets cold, maybe we have some higher levels of energy, some better quality hay for our cows. Maybe we have, we change our rations a little bit in the feedlot to make sure they're getting all the energy requirements they need, because we know they're spending a huge amount of energy just trying to stay in normal body temperature.
What about the bulls? Jason Warner is a Kansas State Extension cow-calf specialist.
The big thing that we're always concerned about when we have severe cold stress and particularly time periods where we've got a lot of ice and frozen ground is frostbite and the potential native impact that that can have on semen quality. And we routinely will see that every year in the early spring as we're coming out of wintertime. And we know that we've got issues, or we can often see issues with bulls. And it's just really important to be thinking about providing some bedding for those bulls and also some wind protection. And so depending on what the management situation is, how those bulls are maintained, particularly if it's maybe a smaller trap pasture or a dry lot area that doesn't have a lot of residual forage cover on that surface of the ground, if bulls are going to be maintained in areas where we've got a lot of bare ground, we really want to be thinking about making sure that we're providing ample bedding, particularly when we get into real extreme situations where we've got lots of cold temperature, lots of wind stress, just to make sure that we're protecting those bulls. Because if it's severe enough, it can certainly negatively impact their ability to pass a breeding soundness exam. And so we want to make sure that we're thinking about those things as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Business-to-business relationships are fundamental to American commerce.
Last Tuesday, U.S. Department of Labor issued a final rule forcing companies to treat some workers as employees rather than independent contractors. North Carolina Representative Virginia Fox.
At its most basic level, a joint employer standard should ensure that the entity calling the shots in the workplace is legally liable. That's why it's important to get this right. Under the Trump National Labor Relations Board rule, it was right. The Trump NLRB made sure that clear criteria were met before an employer was deemed legally liable for an individual's employment conditions. Critically, the Trump rule recognized that the ability of businesses to control their destinies is a pillar of the American dream. It established a standard that enticed countless men and women to start and grow small businesses and employ millions of workers. But the Biden NLRB unended this easy-to-understand joint employer standard that promoted economic growth and job creation. Under the new joint employer rule, small business owners are going to be compelled to acquiesce to more big government regulation and union boss control. Here's why. The traditional Trump rule stated that two or more businesses were considered joint employers under the National Labor Relations Act if they shared actual, direct, and immediate control over the essential terms and conditions of employment, including hiring, firing, discipline, supervision, and direction of employees. This predictable and clear standard ensured employers would not be saddled with collective bargaining obligations or with liability of a company they do not control. But under the Biden NLRB rule, an employer now includes those who have only indirect or even potential control over employees' essential terms and conditions of employment. And like a rerun of a low-rated TV show, we've seen this story before. While the Trump board restored the common sense traditional joint employer standard, the Biden NLRB's rule largely revives an Obama-era standard. The Obama NLRB upended decades of precedent and broadly expanded the definition of joint employment. That means working families and small businesses are up against a confusing and damaging new rule from Biden's NLRB, which will sow confusion and destabilize the economy in a time when persistently high prices are crushing hardworking Americans. The results from Obama's joint employer rule give us an eerie glimpse of what's to come. Franchise operational costs increased by $33 billion. The decision caused 376,000 lost job opportunities in the franchise sector alone. It increased NLRB unfair labor practice charges by 93%, imposing significant litigation costs on businesses, both large and small. Special interests are hard at work attempting to sweep these facts and the failed historical record under the rug. Congress must stand with franchisees, small and large business owners, and millions of workers by voting with a bipartisan mandate to rescind the Biden-NLRB's joint employer rule.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There is optimism by some that a new farm bill will be approved by Congress this first quarter of the calendar year. When asked his thoughts during an RFD TV town hall meeting Thursday, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said this is possible, even with potential challenges within farm bill deliberations, such as
folks want to increase the reference prices. They want more support for the PLC programs, the ARC programs, and so forth. Well, that costs money.
In most cases, that means moving farm bill appropriations from one title to another, which could lead to less support of the total farm bill within Congress. The secretary believes a potential solution could be Commodity Credit Corporation funds to address reference prices.
The ARC payments and the PLC payments and the CRP payments all come from the Commodity Credit Corporation, so they've done it in the past. They just need to get to a point where they understand and appreciate that is the easiest and simplest and best way to get a farm bill done.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.